So what we're going to be talking here, and many of you know, Buddhist teaching is somewhat characterized by the inclination of the Buddha to make lists. Now, actually, this is really very clever in a way, because what the Buddha has done with these lists is to provide certain roadmaps of understanding and certain roadmaps of cultivation. And what the Buddha has done with these lists is actually to sort of unpack this psychological, emotional world in a way in which it is comprehensible to us and in a way that we can understand for ourselves how our world is being structured and created moment to moment. And in reality, when we can understand how our world is being structured and constructed moment to moment, what we're really understanding in that is always coming back to this very central list in the Buddhist teaching of the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, confusion, there is a cause, there is an end, and there is a path to its end. So in many ways, all of the lists of the Buddha come back to really this very kind of central list, we might say. So the Bodhyanga, you know, what we're going to talk about here today, the Bodhyanga, or the factors of awakening, is of course one of these lists that I think we will all be able to relate to in our own experience. But before I start on this, I want to talk a little bit about this particular style of teaching, because, and you know, no offense to anyone here or Sims or whatever else, but I have a little bit of an allergy to the word workshop. because to me there is so often that this tendency to make a division and even a hierarchy in our mind between study and investigation and formal practice. And, you know, the way that the Buddha talked about understanding the path was really threefold. He really talked about three steps of insight. The first of them being intellectual agreement with the teaching. So the Buddha always put this forward as being the first step of insight, that we need to have an intellectual agreement with the teaching through listening to the teaching, questioning it, having that cognitive, conceptual sense of agreement. You can see the sense of this, you know, that if I sat up here and told you, you know, that nothing ever changed, you know, your salvation rested in the hands of aliens, you know, I mean, you would probably listen to me and think, this woman is nuts, you know, she's a fruitcake, you know. It's, you would have no intellectual agreement, and therefore you would really have no encouragement to take the teaching any further. It would be a dismissiveness. The second step of insight that the Buddha talked about was the experiential investigation. To take what you hear, to take what you listen to apply it in your own body-mind experience, to investigate it experientially, to see whether it is true for you. Only that is the kind of litmus test of whether this teaching is valid or worthwhile. And the third step of insight and the third step of the path that the Buddha spoke about is the area of embodiment. It's the area of embodiment. Now, these three steps are so interwoven, you know, the teaching is not complete by having just one of these steps, you know. If we only studied, if we only read, we could have a tremendous intellectual knowledge, be very scholarly, you know, we could have a PhD in Buddhist studies, and our lives could remain actually quite untouched, in fact, by that intellectual knowing. We might have only practice But, you know, why do you practice? You know, what informs your practice? When you turn up on a cushion or go into your walking path, is there a clear sense in your mind of what that time is dedicated to, what it's in the service of, why you are doing it? Quite frankly, there are plenty of creatures in this world who can just sit. You know, from frogs to pussycats to chickens, you know, and not necessarily be that enlightened. Mm-hmm. And the third step, of course, that the path is really only meaningful if it is embodied, if what we understand to be true, it touches and changes our lives on every level. How we relate to our neighbors, how we sit in our car, how we relate to the people we love and the people we struggle with. If this path is not embodied, again, what do we have in our lives but this tremendous gap between our value systems, you know, of valuing having a path of awakening. And yet, quite frankly, if we don't live that path of awakening, if it doesn't change our lives, what is it really that we have except frustration? And a sense of separation and a sense of disconnect. And this teaching is never a teaching of disconnect. It's always a teaching of unifying. Now, it's very important to acknowledge how much emphasis the Buddha actually placed upon study, upon inquiry, upon listening to the teaching. If you remember, for the first 500 years after the Buddha's death, this was an oral tradition. You know, nothing was written down. You know, followers of the way, or people who were practicing, would get together and they would actually sort of, you know, kind of recite the teachings to each other over and over and over again. And it wasn't just, you know, the lack of pen and paper. It was a way, you know, that oral tradition was in a way of kind of naturalizing the teaching or absorbing it almost on a kind of cellular level. You know, today, even in places like Burma, you know, there are people, you know, like there's the seven living treasures. There are people who know by heart the entire Pali Canon. And not just as a sort of memory thing, you know, where, you know, they say, you know, Sutta 128, you know, when that you can actually ask any of these living treasures, you know, where does the Buddha talk about wise intention? And they will bring out the teaching. You know, they will bring out all the suttas where this is talked about. And it's still this kind of emphasis upon, you know, that this teaching can be understood, it can be absorbed, and it's so important that it makes sense to us. And I think, you know, I see in the West there's a little bit of a tendency at times to kind of downgrade the study or the intellectual part, the cognitive part of the teaching. You know, and I think that's very understandable. I'm sure many of you in this room have spent, you know, decades in school, you know, learning and studying, you know, and perhaps you get a little bit kind of into sort of intellectually overweary, you know, and then maybe you feel, oh, finally I come to a path, you know, where I can just sit. You know? But the Buddha cautioned actually against that, and he used the parable of a group of people blindfolded being taken out to, you know, touch an elephant and to report on what the elephant was. And of course one person would touch the tusk and say, you know, well, that's what an elephant is, it's a tusk, you know. Another would touch the leg and say, well, that's what an elephant is, you know, or the tail, and that's what an elephant is. And the fact is that what they were reporting was, of course, entirely true in their direct experience, but it was a sliver of the picture. Just like formal meditation is actually a sliver of the picture of what the Buddha taught. Because the Buddha did not just teach formal meditation. The Buddha taught the cultivation of an awakened life, in which formal meditation is one aspect, certainly an incredibly important aspect, but it sits alongside the rest of the Eightfold Path in terms of wise speech, wise action, wise choice, in terms of embodiment. It sits along the rest of the Eightfold Path in terms of investigation, in terms of understanding, in terms of cultivating wise view. So the point of the elephant parable really is that our direct experience and our formal practice really needs to be in a dialogue with the rest of the path and the rest of the teaching if it's going to lead to liberation. So the Buddha placed this emphasis upon cultivating this kind of wide view, this expansive view of what the path is, because the Buddha didn't just teach, as I mentioned, a practice. He talked a path. But he did talk about, of course, the value and the importance upon direct experience to liberate the mind. Because I think it's not until we sit down on a cushion or we go into a walking path that we really appreciate the size of the cloth. You know, it's not until we actually take the moments to be still and to really look inwardly, and when we look at the sort of landscape of agitation and hindrances and confusion, we actually appreciate that this is really quite a mammoth undertaking in the midst of all of this to cultivate the sort of fruition of kindness, of compassion, of calmness, of insight, of wise understanding. This is no easy task. And when the Buddha spoke about this path, you know, he often used the metaphor that it's swimming against the tide, that the path of awakening is swimming against the tide. And what is the tide that we're swimming against? Well, sometimes, you know, we only need to spend a few moments with ourselves and we see how much we're sometimes swimming against a tide of lifelong habits. You know, lifelong habits of clinging, of selfing, of aversion, of craving, of resistance. And it's in the midst of this that the Buddha talked about the cultivation of a deep inner stillness. In the midst of this, cultivating a deep inner spaciousness, an experiential investigation as being pivotal in transforming our hearts. Now, the third step of insight, the step of embodiment, is sometimes said to be a natural consequence of deep understanding. Sometimes I'm not quite sure how natural it actually is. Because I think often what we're talking about here in a path of waking up is a path of radical inner change. That, and we know, I mean, I don't know how it is for you, but I think we probably would agree that most times it's easier to swim with the tide than to swim against it. You know, and to actually have an embodiment of insight for most of us really requires a substantial amount of commitment and intentionality and dedication and something that is renewed time and time again. But the embodiment is important. You know, without the embodiment, really, what difference does it make what we do? You know, without the embodiment, where do we find confidence and inspiration? Unless we truly do see in our lives, things begin to fall away. And if we don't, you know, we need to see in our lives the possibilities of joy, of stillness, of kindness, of compassion, of clarity begin to come to fruition. You know, and without seeing that, I think there's very little inspiration to actually continue. sometimes mindfulness is really defined as the understanding that everything really does matter. You know, it really does matter to really the kind of footprint that we leave in the world. And it really does matter the kind of footprint that is really left in our own hearts and minds through our practice or non-practice, through our cultivation or non-cultivation, because that is what we live with. That is what defines our lives. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a saying that this mind and this body does the bidding of the wholesome and of the unwholesome. That guided by confusion, this mind and this body tethers us to samsara and to struggle. That guided by wisdom, this mind and this body is a raft to liberation. And embodiment, in my understanding, is really as much of a practice as sitting on the cushion. You know, that sitting on the cushion is not kind of something we tick in the morning or in the evening and feel we've done our practice for the day. We've done a bit of our practice of the day. And, you know, the other 23 hours awaits us to embody what we understand and value. So there is no hierarchy in these three steps of insight. They are considered to be interwoven, to be part of a whole. Okay, so now I've dispensed with the word workshop, and we actually know what we're doing here. Does anybody, before we move on, does anybody? Yes.
So you mentioned commitment and intentionality, and you talked about that last night also, and you just kind of touching on it also. So what drives that? You mentioned defining ourselves, and so commitment and intentionality is sort of what is underlying, you know, insufficiency, and so.
I mean, if you look at this teaching, I mean, you really see how much weight and value the Buddha gives to intentionality and to commitment, you know, as being the forerunner of everything, the forerunner of what we do with our minds and our attention, as being the forerunner of our speech, our actions, our choices. And I think it is a very important question about, you know, what is it that guides intentionality? And I think it's a very big spectrum. You know, sometimes we come to a sense of intentionality and commitment because we've absolutely exhausted all of our strategies of non-commitment. And seeing the futility of all of our strategies of avoidance or aversion. And so I think sometimes we come to a clearer sense of commitment. And I think commitment is really talking about what we value and what we live in the light of and what we nurture. So sometimes I think we come to a clearer sense of commitment through exhausting non-commitment. I think sometimes we come to a sense of intentionality because we see the effects. You know, if you really see how the Buddha spoke about wise intention, it was really, you know, in a very kind of it's a basic form of three wise intentions: are kindness, compassion, and renunciation. And that if those intentions are really at the forerunner of everything, quite frankly, our lives become really much easier and freer. But he spoke about those wise intentions as being antidotes to some of these lifetime habits of aversion and craving and disconnection. But I don't think there's anything magical about coming to a sense of intentionality and commitment to in our lives, because I think for me it's very important to recognize that if you waited to begin to do something, until you had perfect intention and commitment, we would wait a very long time. That very often our commitment and our intentions have more of a sense of ambivalence in them. I'd really appreciate sort of letting go, but the second plate of food looks really good. I really appreciate kindness, but I'll cultivate it tomorrow after I've told this person exactly what I think they need to hear, So there's often a sense of ambivalence in our commitment and our intentionality. And it's just very important to recognize that. And to not feel that, we have to wait for this magical moment, for this 100% wholehearted commitment and intention to arise before we do or undertake anything, because we wouldn't do it. But I think it's acknowledging often the ambivalence of our commitment. Oh yes, I'd like to practice, but Disneyland looks like more fun, I think when we acknowledge the ambivalence of our commitment, that's what we actually practice with, is the ambivalence. Because it's really actually what then we put our weight behind, and that's the commitment. It's about what we put our weight behind in the face of mixed intentionality. If I say I really value kindness, but I need to tell you what's wrong with you, then when I see you, that's the moment of what I'm going to put my weight behind. That's the moment when my mind and body are going to do the bidding of the wholesome or the unwholesome. So I can recognize that the mixture lives there. But then what I put my... So it's almost like the commitment and the intentionality is almost... I really don't like to use this word, but I'm going to use it anyway, purified or made more wholesome by what actually we choose to put our weight behind. Can everybody hear the questions, by the way? Okay. So I mentioned that there's no hierarchy in the teaching between an intellectual understanding, practice, and embodiment. You're saying you're perceiving a hierarchy from where in embodiment?
From the discussion that I just
had. No, there's no hierarchy, because we're not going to embody something unless we understand it experientially and value it. Probably most of us grow up through our lives being told about, good ways to behave and act and speak. Embodiment is not actually something new to us. But unless there's both the understanding of why and the direct experiential valuing inwardly through our own practice, embodiment's just a good idea in my mind. But they work interchange, they all work in a sense of fluidity, They're all working together. Understanding, practice, embodiment are all working simultaneously.
There was a comment by one of the teachers at IMS that her grandfather was more Buddhist than most people should have met, and yet they'd never heard of Buddhism.
Yeah.
So how about the embodiment of the awakened mind without a Buddhist understanding?
So the question is, how about the embodiment of an awakened mind without a Buddhist understanding? Well, quite frankly, there's plenty, plenty may be an exaggeration. There are certainly those in the world who embody and live, compassionate, upright, noble lives and have never heard the teaching. This is not the territory of Buddhists. Not the territory of Buddhists. What we have here is a certain formulation and a certain languaging and a certain pathway made available in this teaching, but that doesn't make it a possession. Okay, so we will continue a little. To talk about these seven qualities of awakening, the Buddha very much spoke about these qualities as noble qualities. in that they lead to liberation. Now, the Buddha described many, many different paths to awakening or nirvana, which you actually find within a lot of the lists. He talks about, you know, cultivating the liberated heart through the Brahmaviharas of kindness, compassion, equanimity and joy. He talks about cultivating awakening through faith. He talks about cultivating awakening through insight. But what you don't see in the discourses, if you read the text, what you don't see in the discourses is nirvana or liberation so much described as being a state. You don't see that. Huh? You don't see it being described as an experience or an event. What you do see in the teachings is liberation or nirvana being described as a fruition of a path. Huh? The flowering, the maturing of a path. So in that sense, nirvana is never actually seen to be separated from the path to nirvana. I personally want to emphasize this because what I see in a lot of Western practice, and I think it's part of our culture, the sort of infatuation with experience and events. And I see a lot of people in practice, you know, kind of practicing with tremendous gusto and sincerity for a time, and then feeling disheartened because they didn't get their own Bodhi tree experience. And thinking, well, you know, where is that event? You know, where is that moment? Where is that experience or state? But that is not how the Buddha talked about awakening. He talked about bhavana, or the path of meditation, really translates as to cultivate or to bring into being. So what we're really doing is to cultivate and to bring into being the ennobling qualities of heart, that when brought to maturity, it is called liberation or nirvana. Now these seven qualities of awakening, the Bhajanga, if you read the discourses, you will find them listed many, many, many times. But the place where I want to refer to them more specifically, because I think it has more to do with a lot of your practice, is the way that these are listed in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is, you know, one of the two meditative discourses that exist. And the seven factors of awakening are very much there in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Everybody has heard at least of the Satipatthana Sutta before. So in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, you see listed the seven factors or the seven limbs of awakening. Sometimes they're described as the seven precious treasures that ennoble our lives, and that their cultivation is a complete path of liberation, and that they are not cultivated just on a meditation cushion, but they are cultivated in the whole of our lives. They are not cultivated specifically as a technique, but they are qualities that are cultivated within all practices of meditation, and they are what make practices of meditation ennobling and liberating. So the Buddha said that these qualities, when they're cultivated and brought to maturity, free the mind and heart of all forms of bondage and suffering. They incline the mind towards liberation. They cultivate an inner climate of mind that is inclined towards transforming understanding. Now, when you think about what we do in formal practice, we don't practice insight, do we? I mean, if we were practicing insight, it would really only be a matter of time before we were really good at it. Huh? But what we do practice in formal meditation is cultivating an inner climate of heart and mind that is receptive to insight. So the qualities of stillness, the qualities of calmness, of receptivity, of mindfulness, all incline the mind towards insight. I think this is important to acknowledge, you know, because, you know, certainly my experience in teaching retreats is for a lot of people, the insights that they encounter and come across, a lot of times they don't happen on a meditation cushion. A lot of times they happen when a person gets up, they open their eyes, they meet the world, they see how they're constructing around the world, there's contact situations, that these are often the moments when insights actually really come to the forefront, understanding what is going on. Whereas often what is being done in a more secluded meditation environment is cultivating all the qualities of heart and mind that allow that seeing to emerge and to deepen. You know, the calmness, the steadiness, the one-pointedness, the stillness. It's a very interesting phenomenon to me, because often people just say, you know, I just need to sit more. You know? Actually, I think, yes, maybe we do need to sit more, but we actually need then to see what is happening when our eyes open and we meet the world. Because it's often in that meeting that insight really emerges. So what we are doing in formal meditation is actually training the mind. We're re-educating the mind. And through the cultivation of the factors of awakening, we are actually learning how to liberate the mind. It's what we're cultivating. Everybody hearing this? I mean, I also just want to kind of retouch on the fourth foundation of mindfulness, because I think for many people in practice, you know, we hear a lot of instruction, a lot of guidance around the first three foundations of mindfulness, you know, about being mindful of the body, mindful of feeling, mindful of mental states. And, you know, quite often we don't actually hear anything mentioned hardly at all about the fourth foundation of mindfulness. It's often kind of left hanging there, you know, like, what is it? But what you see in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, of course, is the layout of the path. The first three foundations of mindfulness are very specific meditative trainings. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness tells us why we're doing it. You know, because on the fourth foundation of mindfulness, you know, that is where you come across the Four Noble Truths, that is where you come across the awakening factors, that's where you come across the, you know, contemplating the construction of selfing. So, what I want to start by doing is by putting into the center of our thinking the teaching of, and even more importantly, the possibility of nibbana and liberation. And any of you who've come to my study retreats before know I tend to harp on about this, because there are many people who suffer, or a certain segment of the meditative population who suffers from an inflated sense of ambitiousness, and far more of our meditative population in the West suffers from a deflated sense of ambitiousness. Ambitiousness may not be the right word. It might be more true to say that we suffer from a deflated sense of aspiration. And yet, without the possibility of real radical awakening, seeing the end of suffering, the uprooting of wrong view and ignorance, this path makes less sense than how the Buddha taught it. So what are we talking about when we speak about bringing these qualities to maturity? What are we talking about when the Buddha speaks about these as being a path to liberation? What he's talking about is liberating the heart from all forms of suffering and distress. He's talking about liberating the heart from all the struggles we engage in with the way things actually are. It's talking about putting down the argument. The argument that we can engage in from morning to night about how things are changing, unable to be grasped, and in reality, not self. It's talking about the liberation from this confusion. And why do we do that? I mean, when you read the Buddhist discourses, and some of you I know will have talked about, done this, you'll see how much of Buddhist teaching is couched in the negatives, isn't it? Huh? That we're letting go of suffering. You know, we're uprooting confusion. We're bringing aversion to an end. You know, we're ending wrong view. And quite frankly, it is simply the way the language of that time was really framed. But what's important to acknowledge, that way of couching the teaching, important as it is, to let go of wrong view, to let go of argument with the way things are, to let go of struggle does not leave a vacuum behind it. What is not being said here often, and I think what we need to remind ourselves of and hear time and time again, that the uprooting of ignorance, the letting go of struggle and ending suffering, is what allows the fruition of joy, of energy, of mindfulness, of investigation, of serenity, of samadhi and equanimity. Now these are qualities, the seeds of these qualities are already present in our own minds. So we are not cultivating something here that is outside of the framework of our experience. And for me, the great genius of the Buddha was that when he talks about the path, he always speaks about the path as a way of building upon something we already know, or building upon something we have already glimpsed. I think if that wasn't the case, it would be a question of blind faith. But I think because the teaching always builds upon what we already know, it is informed confidence. For example, we have all had moments, even if they're far too few and brief, moments of glimpsing genuine kindness, compassion, spaciousness, stillness, calmness, intimacy, receptivity. I don't think this is entirely kind of speaking a foreign language to anybody. We know those moments. And the other part is that we've all touched upon those moments, and no matter how brief they are, those moments tend to speak to us with a kind of convincing authority. We know the value of calmness. I don't think anybody would particularly argue. We know the value of compassion. We know the value of peace. We know it. And so what the path is doing, and what these kind of qualities of awakening are doing, is actually encouraging us to tune in to those seeds present in our own consciousness, in our own hearts, and to cultivate them and to bring them to maturity. Is that clear for everyone? Yeah? So the second, another piece that's very important here is to understand, you know, don't, when you read this list of the seven factors, seven qualities of awakening, don't read them as sort of just words on a piece of paper. These are relational qualities. They are relational. They live in relationship to our body, mind, experience. They live in relationship to our way of interfacing and interacting with the world. They live in relationship to, and this is why I put, you know, you see the seven factors sitting side by side with the hindrance factors. because the awakening factors live in relationship to the habits and tendencies that incline our hearts and minds towards confusion and struggle. Right? So understand that this is always in relation. You know, so the awakening factors are living in relationship to everything that actually sends the heart to sleep. Mm? The ennobling factors are living in relationship with, in a dialogue with, everything that takes nobility away from our lives, takes nobility away from our hearts. They live in relationship to everything that causes disconnection and distress. And quite frankly, look at what causes disconnection and distress. It is the hindrance factors, the nivaranas. Nivaranas, okay? Now, this is an ongoing dialogue. Okay, now I know at this point people start to roll their eyes. You know I teach retreats and I talk about the hindrance factors and people start to roll their eyes. And they think, oh, this is basic stuff, you know. This is like, you know, beginning of retreat issues, you know. I'll just wait them out, you know. Third day I ain't going to wake up, you know. Doesn't have much to do with me, you know. I've got a certain expertise with knowing how to, you know, kind of manage the hindrances, you know. Few long naps, it is such a kind of surface understanding of the hindrance factors. First of all, being aware that of the hindrance factors, there's a certain hardwiring of some of this stuff, you know. There's a certain hardwiring of ill will, aversion. There's a certain hardwiring in craving. You know, long ago in our genetic history, these were very important for our survival. You know, we needed aversion. You know, that sound outside the cave might be a tiger. Hmm? If we didn't have a little bit of craving, we might not go out and hunt and gather and, you know, put food on the fire. There's a certain hardwiring in some of this. You know, every neuroscientist will tell you this. This is a certain inclination of the brain and the mind is to move towards aversion and craving as default mechanisms. They're neural pathways, they're neural ruts, and they are psychological and emotional tendencies and habits. Today, of course, it's not a biological imperative. Mm-hmm. So, you know, through aversion and craving, basically what we're protecting is no longer our cave. We are protecting our habits and we're protecting our sense of self. So, I would like you just to reflect, and you know, this is probably what we'll go into the break with. Reflect on how many of the hindrance factors you've experienced so far today. How much sloth and torpor? And think about the range of sloth and torpor. You know, not just falling asleep, but indifference, numbness, disconnection, times depression, distance, not being touched, looking at life through a veil. Have you experienced any agitation today? Restlessness and worry. It's a better translation. Restlessness and worry. Have you experienced any aversion today? You know, from the impatience, intolerance, you know, to the great hatreds and vendettas. You know, any craving appeared yet? We're quite early on into the day. Any doubt? You know, should I come? No, I got better things to do today, you know. It might be interesting. No, you know, I think I'll go boating or something. I just like you really to reflect on it. Because to really understand the size of the cloth, really understand how much the veiling factors or the hindrance factors are such ongoing companions in our psyches. Not just preliminary meditation experiences. Now you can see, like, when there's listlessness, you know, when there's inertia, when there's sloth and torpor, how important the cultivation of energy and investigation is. What else is going to shift that mental state? You know, you can see when there's aversion and craving, how important the cultivation of equanimity is. What else is going to shift those habit patterns? You know, you can see when there's restlessness and worry, how important the cultivation of calm, of serenity, of tranquility is. What else is going to cool those particular waves? You know, you can see over and over again this relational sense of the factors of awakening to the hindrance factors. Doubt needs investigation. So, I'm sort of keeping an eye on the clock and trying to figure out. Are you ready for a break? Mm-hmm. Would it be helpful at this point to have a walking period, a bit of a stretch, and then come back and we'll have about an hour to continue before we sit before lunch? So as you go into this walking period, and I'd like to suggest this, not as so much as a break, but as a walking period, you know, to find a quiet path, you know, doesn't need to be very long, to establish some mindfulness in that path and be aware of the state of your mind. And be aware of the state of your mind as you walk. And particularly investigate a little bit, what is the state of your mind? You know, is there sloth and torpor? Is there restlessness and worry? Is there aversion or craving or doubt? How do you know it? You know, what is the landscape of that? How do you know it? So allow your walking practice and the movement of your body really to kind of settle you and establish you in the path. But then allow in that walking period just this kind of background investigation, this background inquiry, about what is the state of my mind, how that changes moment to moment, how states of mind can be triggered by sights or sounds or sensations, how some of these hindrance factors can be compound experiences. You know? How there can be sloth and torpor and aversion to the sloth and torpor. Mm-hmm. Hmm? How there can be restlessness and worry triggering craving, you know, the better walking path. So just to take this period really as a kind of experiential investigation,